Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 15-17 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, check out the events page. Next event coming up is in Bentonville, Arkansas. Beautiful Ozarks, Northwest Arkansas, April 16th and 17th. You want to come and hang out with Chad and I and a whole bunch of other people. We're going to be there for 2 days. It's only $65 to come to this particular event. So a two-day event. It's going to be a good time of hanging out, teaching, music, fellowship. Andy Gullihorn's going to be performing an actual concert on Friday night. It's going to be a good time. If you don't know who that is and you've been missing out your whole life until right now when you go check him out. And you can make your 2021 better. Because as we know, the calendar changed and everyone thought that 2020 was the worst year you could possibly ever have. January said, this is the same thing, served up differently. So hopefully it's just January and we'll get back to, you know, I'm choosing to believe that things got real crazy in March. And maybe we just have to have like a whole 12 months of crazy. It's just that's when the year actually starts. So maybe it's just going to last until March and then
I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah. I'm not a prophet or a son of a prophet there. So I don't know. But that's what I'm choosing to believe. Chad, one thing I have decided to do is in honor of finding out that David had a beard, I'm just like growing my facial hair. I don't know if you can tell.
That.
Like,
yeah.
I'm just letting it go.
That's
so
impressive. Yeah.
It's not that impressive yet. We'll see.
Are you planning to act like a madman in the near future or not?
I'm planning on going and living in a cave.
Okay. All right. Well, I hear that things can get pretty pretty crazy in caves.
Yes.
So maybe that's a place to hang out.
Yeah, we're going to be hanging out in some caves today.
Yeah, this is such a weird chapter. We got David and his soldiers, if you want to call them soldiers, his band of ruffians. They're hanging out in the cave. You got Saul stopping by. He's got the call of nature he has to answer. You've got David's longest recorded speech in the Bible occurs in this chapter. He's chopping off part of Saul's robe. Saul's weeping by the end of the chapter. I mean, this is a crazy chapter. There's a lot going on here.
Let's get into it.
So, let's get into it. So we left off with David barely being saved by the report that the Philistines had attacked. And so Saul and his army, they had to run in that direction. And it's interesting when you read the story, because there's like no mention whatsoever of what happened as a result of that. Just like the narrator is not interested whatsoever in reporting what happened with the Philistines. All we're told is that Saul received word the Philistines had attacked. So Saul had to leave off chasing David in order to go and attack the Philistines. And there's no report whatsoever about what happened.
Yeah,
so did they lose or what?
Yeah, in fact, I mean, the first verse of chapter 24 references it, but doesn't tell you anything about what went down. It just says, when Saul returned from following the Philistines. So he just chased them out.
Possibly so. I mean, it is just typical of this particular narrative that the sole concern, or we should say the primary concern, is what happens with David. Everything is narrowed down to him, which of course is what we talked about at the beginning of 1 Samuel, that this is David's story. It's not really about Samuel. In fact, at the beginning of the next chapter, Samuel's going to die. So at the beginning of 1 Samuel 25, Samuel dies. And then he makes a brief appearance later on. But for the most part, he fades out of sight. And the rest of the book is just about, rest of the two books are about David. So 1 and 2 Samuel really should have been entitled 1 and 2 David. But this is a case where the narrative is all about him, and at this point in David's life, all about him and Saul. So it came about, yes, when Saul got back from chasing the Philistines, that he found out once more where David was. So he found out he was hiding in the wilderness of En-Gedi, which is where we left him off at the end of chapter 23. So Saul does what Saul has done before. He gathers a force and goes after David. In this case, he takes 3,000, not just 3,000 soldiers, but 3,000 chosen men from all of Israel. So he's going to take his best. And keep in mind that David, at this point, has 600 men. So he's outnumbered 5-1. So you would think that Saul would have a pretty good chance of finding David, and if he does find him, of taking him out. but that's not the way things are going to go. So he and his soldiers go to seek David and his men in front of the, well, it's either a place name or it's either just a description of where they are. The New American Standard has Rocks of the Wild Goats, and that's pretty close to what the ESV has as well. So maybe it was just a place name close to En Gedi. That's where they are. And there's some sheep nearby. We have the sheepfolds that are mentioned in verse 3. And there's a cave close to where these sheepfolds are. One commentator suggested that perhaps the sheepfolds are mentioned here because kind of an underlying theme of this chapter is who's going to be the shepherd of Israel, which I thought was pretty clever. Mm. Which, I mean, really is what it's all about. Is David or Saul going to be the shepherd, the leader of Israel?
Now, I don't know if all 600 of his men are in this cave. It says David and his men. But if so, this is a massive cave.
Yeah, they're probably spread out. The area around this is evidently just full of caves. And many of these are honeycombed caves, just kind of openings all over the place. So I'm guessing, of course, I don't have any evidence of this, but I'm guessing they're kind of spread out. You have to find a pretty big cave to hide 600 men. So they're probably, you know, in this general area, but spread out here and there. So David and some of his men, at least, are in this cave. And it just so happens that as Saul is passing by here, that he needs to go in and answer the call of nature. Literally, he goes in to cover his feet because he is going to be squatting down and his robe is going to be covering his feet. Now, I can't help but think that this is actually a purposeful allusion back to the only other occurrence of this particular idiom in the entirety of the scriptures. So if you were listening with us back in the book of Judges, you remember that one of the early stories was about a very obese king by the name of Eglon. And God raised up a left-handed guy named Ehud from the tribe of Benjamin. And Ehud fashioned for himself a short dagger. And he went to deliver the payment that the Israelites owed to Eglon.
Yeah,
while he was there.
The literal translation is, I've got something for you.
Yeah. I got something for you, king. I have a word from God, I believe is what he said, said to the king. And Eglon was, kind of curious. Really, really. So anyway, they go into a room by themselves. And of course, Ehud ends up stabbing Eglon so deeply that the whole hilt of his dagger disappears inside of Eglon's very large stomach. But what happens after that is that his servants think the king, even though he's dead, the servants think the king has gone in to cover his feet. So they think that he's basically using the restroom. So if a purposeful allusion has been in 1 Samuel 24 back to Eglon, this is an insult to Saul because it's basically making a comparison between Eglon, a foreign king, and now Saul, the current king. And then it also puts David in kind of the place of Ehud. And the question is David going to pull out his own dagger and take out his enemy like Ehud did to Eglon, or is he not? So that's the situation. So Saul is exposed in more ways than one. It says at the end of verse 3 that David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave. So they're hiding in the back of the cave. Now, you're one of David's men, and you're back there. You're in the dark. You see Saul come in, and what are you going to say? What are you going to tell David?
I'm going to tell David that I'm getting tired of living in caves. They got 3,000 guys out there. You could end this by just killing one guy, and that would be better for everyone.
Yeah, it'd be easy, right? I mean, take him out, no problem. He would never know what hit him.
Yeah, because it's not like it's just David's life in jeopardy. I mean, these 600, we know how Saul has treated those who simply give aid to David. You can imagine how he's going to treat those who have teamed up with him. Any of these guys get caught, it is fair to assume that they're dead.
Yeah. I mean, it just kind of makes sense. It makes common sense to take advantage of the opportunity.
Yeah, you, David. You, I think David's men are like, save yourself and all of us right now. Like, I mean, we can all get out of this alive if you just do this one simple thing.
Yeah,
and not and only that, but it seems like God has given him over to your hand. Like God has just made this so easy for you.
Right. Yeah, as I was going to say, they even come up with a theological rationale. They say to David, whispering, no doubt, "Look, hey, David, look, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I am about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you." Now, we have no evidence that God told David this. I mean, you do hear some of this reflected in some of his Psalms, but I wonder if the men are not just kind of making this stuff. They're looking, hey, David, God has just provided this opportunity for you, and he's given his enemy into your hand, so why don't you do what seems right, because you would be a fool to pass up this golden opportunity.
This seems like they're saying, you don't even need to inquire in the Lord about this one. I think that it's pretty obvious that God wants you to do whatever you want right now.
Yeah. I was reading the translation and commentary by Robert Alter, and he calls this theological presumption, which I thought was a pretty good way of putting it. Yeah, it is, and he made the point that, you know, we all kind of have these situations where we try and interpret events as if, oh, well, this God had to have provided this opportunity for me because everything is just perfect for me to do.
Well, if it's, I mean, extend the David's men a little grace. I mean, they are like, what do you think? This is a coincidence? What kind of coincidence is this? Like, right. I mean, this would be a pretty radical coincidence that Saul goes wandering into the cave that you happen to be in all by himself, squats down, and you're like, that seems like God, dude.
I mean, this is more than just good fortune.
There are supernatural things at work here.
Yeah, and to their credit, also, they were partially correct. They were right that this was God had arranged this particular situation. They were wrong in that, well, let me put it this way. They didn't come right out and say, hey, David, kill Saul. I mean, they weren't quite as explicit as that.
It's deeply implied.
Right, but it's very deeply implied. They're like, do what's good. Do what seems good to you. Wink, wink. So what does he do? Well, I think the way that it's narrated is a bit out of temporal sequence. So we'll have to read the next two or three verses to kind of get the whole of what happened. Because I'm thinking at this point, David actually said something to them. What's first reported is he did something, but I think he probably said something to them. But we'll just kind of read it the way it's narrated. So after they give their little theological speech, David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly, which pretty impressive. And it came about afterward that David's conscience bothered him. Well, that's the New American Standard. I don't do this very often, but in my English Bible, when I come across translations that are just too weak, I will actually cross out the English word and replace it with another word. So I crossed out bothered, and I wrote in its place smote, because that's the literal Hebrew here. That his conscience, the verb there is nakah, which is the verb used to, like, when God strikes someone down, he nakahs them.
Yeah,
it wasn't like his conscience kind of bothered him a little bit afterward. No, it's like God took his fist and hammered into David's conscience. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, the ESV translates it, and afterward, David's heart struck him.
That's good. Yeah, yeah, that's an accurate translation. It wasn't just it bothered him. Yeah, his conscience struck him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robes.
David's a different kind of guy. That's a different kind of conscience right there too, man. I'll tell you what.
That's a very different kind of conscience. Yeah.
I'm sure his men were like, what a weirdo. Like that's the thing you decided to do? And they would think that you had just done the most gracious thing ever. Like there's no one is more gracious than David. And David's like, oh, I was messed up. I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he does have it's fascinating to watch his changes over the years. I mean, when you think about, okay, this what seems to us a minor act really smote his conscience. And then you see what happens you know, later on with Uriah and Bathsheba and some other things as well. You don't really see his conscience quite as tender at that point.
No, it tells you, it shows you how complicated people are, right?
Like, so
This immediately he feels bad about having Uriah killed. I mean, this he doesn't feel bad about at all until like somebody has to come and explain to him why he should feel bad about it.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about the scriptures is it does reveal how complicated people are. I mean, we'll see in just a few verses how complicated Saul is. And we've seen this throughout his story, how he starts out and he's very kind of self-effacing. He's very humble. He's just like, you know, like, who am I to be king? You know, I'm just a guy.
He was a dude hiding among the baggage and stuff.
Yeah.
And, I mean,
right. He wasn't
definitely progressed.
Wasn't stepping out saying, kingship, that fits me. No, it was quite the opposite. And of course, we've seen how he's changed over the course of the years. So anyway, at this point, yeah, David's conscience bothers him. And he says to his men in verse 6, far be it from me because of the Lord that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to stretch out my hand against him since he is the Lord's anointed. And David persuaded his men with these words and did not allow them to rise up against Saul. And Saul arose and left the cave and went on his way. So I think this is what I was referring to earlier, where things are a little bit out of temporal sequence. Probably what happened is the men give their little speech, take out your enemy. David then responds by saying, no, I can't do that because this is the Lord's anointed. How dare I stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed? And we're going to see when we get to chapter 26 that something similar happens then. His men want to kill Saul. David says no.
I mean, now, is there anything about this that makes you think David obviously interprets their words the way that we interpreted them, that they are heavily implying that he should go kill them, or he should go kill Saul. And David says, no, I'm not doing that. That's the Lord's anointed. Like, the Lord's going to have to take him out. I'm not doing that. And then, like, the sort of, I don't know if it's, David's still probably young-ish. I mean, he's a young man. I think about me in my 20s. I can see an instance you're like, no, I'm not doing that. But watch this. And you know, you're with all your boys and you're like, and you go and you're like sneaking over there and you're cutting. I mean, is it, and then he feels bad about it, you know, later. Like, I shouldn't have done that. Like, and you're really just, I mean, it almost seems like David just like messing with him, right? Like, he's going to later on figure out, like, he's going to see this. It's going to be, and he feels bad about it. Like, it's like childish and it's, you know, instill something that he did to, insult the Lord's anointed, you know?
Right, right. And I think another thing that's probably going on here too is the reason he feels bad about it is, I mean, there is something to the king's robe that's sort of emblematic of his office, mm-hmm. you know, where, because remember that we had the story back in, I can't remember what chapter that was, maybe 15. Anyway, it's when Samuel starts to walk away from Saul and Saul reaches out and grabs his garment and tears it.
Yeah.
And then the prophet says, the Lord will tear the kingdom away from you. So I'm thinking probably just, you know, the symbolic act of what we might say, touching the king's crown, I suppose would be something along the lines of this. And he feels bad about that.
And I mean, if you go do this thing, if you don't kill Saul, but you go cut off the corner of his robe, you have kind of put everyone in danger at this point. Yes. I mean, this is a risky thing to do.
Yeah. No, and not as risky as what he's about to do. I mean, that in itself was a terribly risky move, but then he follows that up, of course, as we'll see in just a second, by actually going out of the cave and confronting Saul with the edge of the robe that he just cut off. By the way, a little Hebrew comment here. Verse 7 says that David persuaded his men with these words. And that's, I think, a pretty common English translation of that. It's actually an extremely forceful word. when we read back in books like Leviticus about the cloven hooves, so hooves that are split, that's the same root of this word here. So it's the idea of split or tearing in two. So we might, using idiomatic English, might say something like David tore into his men with these words. So he was going out of his way to try and persuade them against any kind of violent action against Saul. So let's pick it up with what happens next. So Saul leaves, puts his robe back on, leaves the cave, goes on his way. Verse 8, David steps out, goes out of the cave, and he calls after Saul. And I'll just go ahead and read the speech. It's about 6 or 7 verses long. David says to Saul, "My lord, the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Behold, David seeks to harm you'? Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord had given you today into my hand in the cave. And some said to kill you, but my eye had pity on you. And I said, I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. Now, my father, see the edge of your robe in my hand. For in that I cut off the edge of your robe and did not kill you, know and perceive that there is no evil or rebellion in my hands. And I have not sinned against you, though you are lying in wait for my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you, and may the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom are you pursuing? A dead dog? A single flea? Therefore, the Lord therefore be judge and decide between you and me. And may he see me, and may he see and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand." So as I mentioned earlier, I think that is the longest recorded speech of David in the Bible. And it's really it's a great speech. There's a whole lot of different approaches that David uses to try and persuade Saul of his innocence and the fact that he's not a threat whatsoever to Saul. It's interesting the way he starts out by calling him my lord, the king, and then he bows down with his face to the ground and prostrates himself. So in that very action, David is saying, look, I wouldn't be bowing down before you if I didn't think that you were the legitimate God-anointed king.
Yeah, this is a way of David saying, I have not laid claim to the throne. I'm not going around calling myself the true king of Israel or anything.
The would-be king does not bow, does not prostrate himself before the other king. Not if he thinks he needs to leave office.
Yeah, he does like two things here, right? Like he calls him his lord and his king, and then he will move to referring to him as father, which of course is true enough that he is his father-in-law, right? So, I mean,
right.
He's sort of pleading to him as a member of his family. It also seems to me that this speech was not David's plan when he initially cut off the corner of Saul's robe, that he went and did that and then felt real bad about it immediately, it seems. It seems that this is an immediate conscious striking that happened, and then goes out and just God works all things together for good. He's like, "Well, I got this. I'm gonna use it now." But that his plan was not the whole time. Like, I'm gonna, because otherwise he would not. Why would he feel bad about this, right? I mean, like, if this is the plan,
right.
I think he cut it off, maybe even as an insult, as you were saying, and then felt bad and immediately went out and made this speech.
Yeah, he's being very shrewd. And he's quick, too. I mean, of course, there's no way he could have known this was going to happen. So there's no way he, like, sat down and thought through, okay, I'm going to give a speech to Saul, a very public speech. So what should I say? So he's quick on his feet. He's shrewd. And he's taking advantage of, he's trying to make the most out of the opportunity that he has. And as you say, he calls him my lord, he calls him my king, and he calls him my father. So he's appealing to him both with regard to his authority as well. I mean, there's a lot of emotional appeal here too.
Yep.
You know, he's calling him, listen, I'm your son or your son-in-law, and you're my father-in-law, kind of my adopted father. And then he says, you know, why are you listening to these false accusations? Why are you listening to anybody that says that I seek to harm you? Here, you know, here's evidence, more or less. He said, the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. So he acknowledges that this didn't just happen. This was the Lord's doing. He brought you to this particular cave. And some of them told me to kill you, but I didn't, because I wouldn't do that to the Lord's anointed. Then he holds up the evidence, the edge of his robes. Then verse 13 is interesting. He quotes this proverb. He says, as the proverb of the ancients says, out of the wicked comes forth wickedness, which is just three words in Hebrew. It's very much like what Jesus says, right? You will know a tree by its fruits. But it's a pretty common biblical image of wickedness coming forth from the wicked, or, you know, bad trees producing bad fruit, good trees producing good fruit. And what David is saying is listen, if I were wicked, that is to say, if I were actually out to kill you, then would I not do that?
Yeah.
Because out of the wicked comes forth wickedness.
Yeah, I think that some people could maybe read this and initially think that David is saying, you do wicked things because you're wicked, which is not what he's saying. I mean, that's true. But what he is saying is, why don't you audit my actions, and will you not find that I'm not wicked because I'm not out here doing wicked things against you?
Yeah, yeah. That's why he follows it up by saying, but my hand shall not be against you. Meaning, if I were truly full of wicked intentions to kill you, then my hand would be against you. You would be able to tell by the fruit I bear what kind of person I am.
It's also interesting that, you know, when he talks about why are you listening to these people who say these things about me, and we haven't heard like a single person say any of this. The only thing that Saul, as far as we know, that the only voices Saul is listening to are the voices in his own head.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're now people have learned probably not to push back against these accusations, because that doesn't end well. But David is really appealing to him to stop listening to himself.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he is. Yeah, maybe David is putting the best construction on this and thinking, you know what? Somebody's got to be telling Saul that I'm after him.
Yeah, because nothing
else makes sense.
The only thing we've seen as far as people referring to this situation is them saying, "Wait, what? You think David's out to get? What are you talking about?"
Yeah, and that's right. There's not been a single instance where anybody has said to Saul, "You better watch David. Man,
no.
He's out to get you." In fact, from the very beginning, I guess the first time that Saul experienced any kind of, you know, jealousy or possible fear of David is when the girls started singing their David is greater kind of songs. But, you know, I was completely on Saul. It was always him just, you know, being his own worst enemy, telling himself these lies. And then after a while, fully believing the lies that he's been telling to himself. And then David gets close to the end, and he more or less says, "You know, what am I, or who am I that you're coming after me? Listen, you don't you have better things to do?" He uses a pretty common Hebrew image of, you know, something that's kind of worthless, and that's a dead dog. Verse 14: "Whom are you pursuing? You know, a dead dog." And then to double down on that, he's like, "You know what? I'm not even a dead dog. I'm like a single flea on a dead dog. That's who I am. I'm not worth pursuing." He's going to use that same image, by the way, in chapter 26, where he compares himself to a flea. And his point is, listen, you're king. You have Philistines to worry about. You've got a whole kingdom to take care of. Why in the world would you be spending so much time and energy and expenses out here running from place to place in the wilderness, trying to track me down? I'm no threat to you whatsoever. No more a threat to you than a single flea would be a threat to you. And then there's for all of his protestation of innocence against Saul, at the same time, there is a, I don't know if we want to call it a threat, like a subtle threat, but there is certain a realism that David has here, where he basically says, listen, the one who ultimately decides this is not me or you, it's God. So he says, the Lord be judge and decide between you and me. And may he see and plead my cause and literally judge me from your hand. It's a sense of deliver me from your hand. So when he gets to the end, he gets extremely theological and says, listen, you know, the ultimate judge is the one who's going to decide who's in the right and who's in the wrong here. And it's not going to be you and it's not going to be me. So it's a great speech. It's really appeals from all different sides for Saul to listen and to change his mind. So what kind of impact does this make on Saul? Well, it's a pretty amazing impact. Verse 16 wraps it up by saying, it came about when David had finished speaking these words to Saul that Saul says, is this your voice, my son David? Then Saul lifted up his voice and wept. That's a pretty moving scene there. I'm assuming that he can't tell that it's David because his eyes are so full of tears. I could be wrong there, but you know, it's a reminder of the scene with Jacob and Esau and old Isaac. Isaac, you know, is this? It was Jacob speaking, but he's like, whose voice is this?
Yeah.
So Saul is kind of in the place of blind Isaac here. But I'm assuming that, yeah, he's crying. He's listening to the speech from David, and the Lord has actually struck his own conscience, the conscience of Saul. So this is the first recorded time that Saul weeps. We've had a lot of weeping in the book of Samuel, but none from Saul. So at this point, he does. He cries out. He weeps, and he refers to, he finally calls him by name. I just noticed that.
Yeah, yeah. He's called him the son of Jesse pretty regularly for a while.
Yeah, yeah. He won't even say his name. And not only does he call him David, but he calls him my son. So he echoes what David said to him and calling him father. Then he goes on, verse 17. He says, you are more righteous than I am, for you have dealt well with me while I have dealt wickedly with you. And you have declared today that you have done good to me, that the Lord deliver me into your hand, and yet you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? May the Lord therefore reward you with good in return for what you have done to me today. And then he goes on. Now look, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. So now, swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's household. So David swore to Saul, and Saul went to his home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. There's a hint there at the end of that closing verse that things are not quite what they should be yet, because there's still a parting of ways. Saul goes his way. David and his men stay where they are. This is kind of similar, I suppose, to the conversation that Jonathan had with Saul a few chapters back, where Saul acknowledges that it would be wrong for him to do that, to take David's life, and he swears to his son that he won't do it. So he does have these moments of clarity, of, I guess we would say, spiritual clarity, as well as just kind of mental clarity, where he seems to actually speak like a human being should, someone who's in their right mind, someone who is actually not just in the right mind, but is penitent because of their actions. It's short-lived, unfortunately, as we'll see in chapter 26. But at this point, he is at least openly acknowledging that David is in the right and he's in the wrong.
Yeah, I think this tells you, too, like, since he is having a moment of clarity, he does sort of show you what one of his major concerns is, which is that he believes that if he doesn't take David out, that David will in fact be king, and that he is concerned about his family, right? So he's concerned about his lineage and his name, his household. And so this is at least partially what's behind the motivation to eliminate David. It isn't just that he thinks that he's going to get overthrown, which he is. He does seem to have convinced himself that David is going to try to kill him and take the throne from him, but also that what that means for the rest of his family.
So he's sort of a Walter White approach, right? I'm only doing this for my family.
Yeah, and he's not only doing this for his family. But he's just partially, he is, let's assume that he is partially doing it for his family.
Yeah, he is partially doing it for his family. You know, there's a, we've heard the echo of Isaac. There's also an echo here of what Judah says to Tamar in verse 17. So Saul says to David, "You are more righteous than I." And after Tamar tricked Judah into sleeping with her, dressed up like a prostitute, Judah hired her. And then Judah finds out that his daughter-in-law is pregnant. He assumes that she has committed adultery, and so he's going to have her punished. And when she reveals that he's actually the father of her children, then he says to her, "You are more righteous than I." So proven to be in the wrong, and for the opponent to be in the right. And yeah, he knows. Verse 20, he openly acknowledges that one of these days that David will in fact be king. And so accepting that, he says, "I only ask one thing, that you will not cut off my descendants after me." That is the fourth occurrence, by the way, of that verb karat, for cut, that we've seen. It's used twice in reference to David's cutting off the edge of Saul's robe in verse 4 and verse 5. Then David refers to it again in verse 11. And now verse 21, it's that same verb. So that's why I think this is also an emblematic act, which David is kind of suggesting by this action, even if unintended, that Saul will actually be cut off from his throne.
Yeah, this is an easy oath for David to make, considering that he's already made this oath to Jonathan as well.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. Yeah. Yeah, he's already told Jonathan that everything will be good.
If Saul would have had a short conversation with Jonathan that he actually would have been willing to listen to, he could have already known that David was not going to just exterminate the house of Saul altogether. Of course, not to spoil it, but this Jonathan doesn't live to, you know, be at David's side. But you have to assume, I mean, I assume that if he had, that that's exactly what would have happened.
Yeah, I assume that it would. I mean, David and Jonathan had been so close, had loved one another as deeply as two close friends can. So chances are, if Jonathan had survived that battle, that final battle, that eventually he would have been David's second. He would have been his right hand man, and there would have been it probably would have been good for the kingdom, because you would have had the Saul side connected with the David side, and you wouldn't have had this long period, this several period of a division within Israel after the death of Saul. Because to kind of skip ahead, after the death of Saul and Jonathan, David is proclaimed king by part of Israel, but he's not accepted by all of Israel. So there's a gap of several years where David has to begin to kind of unify the kingdom. So even after the death of Saul, we don't have that unity yet, but we probably would have. Of course, we're just kind of guessing, had Jonathan survived and been David's right-hand man.
Yeah, yeah. It's weird. People don't think about Jonathan a lot. Jonathan dying seems like it's a pretty big, that's a pretty big bummer for the history of Israel. It does seem like there's a lot of conflict and turmoil that could be fixed if this were not the case. And this is one of those things where you kind of trust that God knows what he's doing, because you're like, wouldn't it have been better, God, if...
Right.
Like, yeah. It seems like David could have really used someone like Jonathan, because Jonathan, as good as... Like, David, I mean, Saul says, "You're more righteous than I am." I'm like, I don't know. Jonathan seems more righteous than David. So, yeah. I mean, it just seems like a good guy to have around for David. Would have kind of unified, the people. It seems like so many plus. I mean, you can almost not think of any minuses or negatives to Jonathan being around.
No, you can't. Now, I mean, he lives up to the meaning of his name, Yehonatan, which means the Lord has given. So he really was. He was a gift to his family. He was a gift to Israel. He was certainly a gift to David. He's a pivotal player in 1 Samuel, much more so than we sometimes realized, as an encouragement to David, a protector of David, someone who probably kind of helped David keep going, because he was such an encouragement to him. So his loss, his early death was a blow to David for sure, but also a great loss for Israel.
Yeah. Well, that's it, man. That is chapter 24. Next week, we'll get into 25. We're going to have a little short thing about Samuel, real short. You think it's weird that First Samuel is named First Samuel. Second Samuel is really weird named.
yeah, this is true. So, yeah, next chapter is it's quite a story. Abigail and her foolish husband. I mean, his name actually means fool. So it's a crazy story coming up.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll see you then.
All right. See you then.